Welcome back to the American Revolution Podcast, Episode 51, The Turtle. Once the American Army moved to the New York City area, Washington puts to use the first ever combat submarine to defend the Hudson River. Rumors of a submersible vessel that had the power to destroy a British warship were circulating through the American lines as early as October 1775. The man in charge of building this wonder weapon was Robert Bushnell of Saybrook, Connecticut. Born August 30, 1740, Bushnell came from a farming family. Though he loved to read, his duties on the family farm kept him from advancing far in schooling. He would, however, have his chance. When his father died when he was 30, he left him a small inheritance. Bushnell would then leave the family farm and receive tutoring from Saybrook Congregationalist pastor John Devotion, who would help prep him for Yale. Bushnell was 35 when he graduated. He studied medicine, advanced mathematics, and physical science. While in college, Bushnell experimented with the idea of exploding gunpowder underwater. He theorized that depending on the size of the charge, they could be used to blow up ships. He named the apparatus a torpedo after the stinging crabfish called torpinidae. I'm not really sure if I pronounced the Latin word correct, but we'll leave it right there. The question was now, what would be the delivery system? He thought that he could develop a submersible that could travel under the surface of the water. Now, this isn't a novel concept. Talk of underwater warfare went back to Alexander the Great. By June of 1774, Bushnell would have plenty of targets to test out his new system in and around Boston Harbor. Robert, with his younger brother Ezra, will work on the submersible at his family farm in Saybrook, while attending his final year of Yale. The Bushnell brothers did come very close to building a working sub. Ezra Bushnell was the pilot who would make history. And in August of 1775, Dr. Benjamin Gale of Connecticut heard of Bushnell's success and went to see it for himself. A graduate of Yale, he had the ear of another important scientist in Philadelphia, Benjamin Franklin. Gale wrote an account of all he witnessed while in the company of Bushnell and his sub. He described the sub as a single-man vessel, which was about 7 feet tall and about 5.5 feet wide. A single operator sat on a bench and could stand underwater for over 45 minutes without surfacing for air. The operator was able to move freely in the water, surfacing and diving at will. It had a keg of powder on the back that the sub could detach under an enemy warship that could be set off once the sub was safely away. This was great news, at least for the Continental Congress. Not so much for Robert Bushnell. As word of his creation was circulating throughout Congress, his top-secret project suddenly was not so secret. Others began to take what information they had of Bushnell and his sub and recreate their own. Bushnell became very reclusive. Only he and his brother had access to the sub at this point. The winter of 75 forced testing to a halt until the following spring. The only problem was the fact that by March of 1776, the siege of Boston had lifted and the British evacuated the city. But Bushnell isn't deterred. He knows that there will be another opportunity for him to test his wonder weapon against the British Navy. And we know that he's right, because in July of 76, the war shifts from New England to New York City. It would be one of the largest armadas the world had ever seen that the British land at Staten Island. Now, Bushnell would arrive in New York City in August, and the climate was tense, to say the least. Not only were there 300 warships to contend with, but his brother Ezra took ill and could not pilot the Turtle. Bushnell went to Brigadier General Samuel Parsons. He was a former member of the Connecticut Committee of Safety. Bushnell asked him for two or three men that he could test out as a new pilot. The man chosen, funny enough, was Sergeant Ezra Lee of the 5th Connecticut. Lee needed a couple weeks to train in the sub, and in that time, the British had captured Brooklyn and Governor's Island. It would soon be time to put the Turtle into action. On September 5th, General Parsons sent word to General William Heath, commanding the troops around Kingsbridge, that the Turtle was on its way from New Rochelle and would need passage to the Hudson River. On the night of September 6, the world's first combat sub would go into action. Now, the Long Island Sound is a far cry from the rough currents of the Hudson River and New York Harbor. But Lee knows the gravity of the situation. He knows that this test needs to be successful. This could really turn the tide of the war if they could use the submersible to destroy British warships. You gotta remember, the Americans really don't have much of a navy, so the fact that the Bushnell sub was their real best option to taking down warships, this test was going to be looked at and looked over for years to come. Well, Lee kept a pretty detailed account of everything that happened that night, and I'm not going to direct quote Lee, but everything that I say from now until we end, I guess, the discussion of his target, the HMS Eagle, is going to be a overview of everything that he wrote in his journal about how the first run against the British Navy actually went. So his quarry was the HMS Eagle. She had 64 guns and would make the perfect target to take down one of the biggest warships that the British Navy had would really send a statement. As Lee moved underneath the Eagle, he prepared to use a drill bit to set the charge into the hull of the Eagle. Now, this is one thing I didn't go over. I talked about this, you know, the kind of overview of it. The turtle itself had several screws, as if you want to call them. They're like water turbines, similar to what you would see on a submarine today. They look like a really large auger bit, auger drill bit. What happens is they swirl, and there's one on the top and one in the front, and those were directional. On that very top of the sub, there is a smaller drill bit, and it's an actual auger bit that the operator could use, and you would drill a hole in, and that would set the rope for the charge, for the torpedo charge, which would kind of affix it to underneath the ship so it wouldn't float away before the timer went off. So Lee tries to drill into the hull of the Eagle, but it doesn't go through. And when he is recounting this later to Bushnell, Bushnell assumed that he hit the metal rudder plate that runs underneath the keel of the ship. So as he tried to adjust his position, he unexpectedly surfaced. And now this freaked Lee out, because Lee now has just popped up, and he probably could have been seen. So he has to try and reacquire his position. And he found himself floating near Governor's Island. Worried that the garrison may have caught sight of him, he let loose the torpedo, well, in case he was captured. Luckily, the British were so confused at what they saw that Lee was able to get away. An hour later, the fireworks began when the torpedo went off. Now, unfortunately, it didn't go off underneath the Eagle or anywhere near any other warship. But the explosion scared the heck out of the British, so I guess consolation prize. The explosion was met with a roaring approval from the Patriots in the city, especially Israel Putnam. Now, Putnam was a big supporter of the Turtle Project. And when the torpedo exploded, even though it did no damage, he knew that the British saw what had happened, and it was very close to their warship, so I'm sure that they started second-guessing things. And the man could only cry out in joy, saying, "Curse them all, that'll do it for him." 9 days later, the turtle would have to be transported up to Fort Washington. The Patriots were being driven from New York City, and they were now going to reform their lines at Fort Washington and Harlem Heights. The turtle was going to be put back to action about a month later. On the night of October 5th, the turtle was back in the water with a new target. This time, it was going to be the HMS Phoenix. Now, it had run the defenses at Fort Washington before. We had talked about that in several episodes. Fort Washington, very early on, we were talking about when the British first arrived, ships were running up the Hudson River trying to surround Washington and his position on the East River and Hudson River. So the HMS Phoenix was no stranger to running past the river defenses in and around Manhattan Island. And well, they frankly weren't going to allow the Phoenix to run the defenses again, so the Turtle was sent into action. Now, Lee wanted to avoid the same problem he had with the Eagle. So he thought, maybe I can attach the torpedo at the waterline. You don't have the same problem where you're going to surprisingly surface, or you're going to run into the problem with the rudder plate underneath the ship. But the problem is that now you're drilling at the waterline, so now the problem is you can be seen. And that, unfortunately, is exactly what happens. Lee is caught trying to attach the torpedo to the side of the ship by the ship's watch, and he is forced to retreat. He's able to get the Turtle back to a sloop that they had upriver that was going to transport the Turtle to a new location farther up the Hudson, except the British Navy was following. And the British Navy caught up to the sloop and sunk the sloop with the Turtle. Now, luckily, the British Navy had no idea what the Turtle was or recognized its potential. So, after the British Navy left and the ship was sunk to the bottom of the Hudson, the Turtle itself wasn't damaged, and it is a submarine. It's meant to stay underwater, so it wasn't difficult for the Patriots to recover the Turtle sub. The only unfortunate thing was the Turtle would go into mothballs. After two failed attempts, there were going to be no more use for the submersible in the American Revolution. And that kind of ends submarine warfare for the American Army during the American Revolution right there. But it's not the end of the war for Robert Bushnell. See, Washington recognized his talents, and he decided to make him an officer in the Corps of Sappers and Miners in August of 1779. And he was in service at Yorktown and advanced far enough in the Continental Army by the end of the war, he was a commander of the Army Corps of Engineers at West Point. After the war, he went back to living his reclusive lifestyle. He was part of the Fraternal Society of Cincinnati. Try and say that three times fast. Now, this was a group of Revolutionary War veterans that named themselves after the Roman general Cincinnatus, who twice answered the call for the Republic, but once the war was over, went back to his home and to his farm. Now, I'm not familiar with the history of the Fraternal Society of Cincinnatus. I've never really looked into them. All I know is what you could basically find on the internet. This was a group of Revolutionary War veterans. They named themselves after the Roman general Cincinnatus. He was twice called on as consul for the Roman Empire. This basically puts you in command of the military with no real authority but your own. So you're basically a dictator. And they used these dictators to run things while in wartime because they knew that the efficiency of having one leader versus a republic or a group of men talking was much quicker, especially when you're trying to answer attacks from people like Hannibal and the barbarians. So for Cincinnatus, twice he's called on to fight wars for the Roman Empire. He has control of the Roman Empire. And twice, once the war was done, relinquished his power and went home. And that's what Washington was asking of these men. To, now that we have, we asked you guys to be soldiers. We asked you guys to answer the call. Now it's time to go home and go back to being the farmer or the tailor or whatever your job was before the war began. Sorry, that was an extra history note that we are adding into our subject of the submarine warfare. But yes, that's the backstory of the Fraternal Society of Cincinnati. Now, he is part of the Fraternal Order of Cincinnati. And in 1794, he's thought to be dead. His reclusive lifestyle did exactly that. No one had any idea where this man went. There's actually an obituary put out from one of the professors of Yale for the man in one of their yearly reviews, saying that Bushnell had died. The only thing is, he would actually live until 1826. He actually went he altered his name. He went by Dr. Bush. I guess, you know, his reclusive lifestyle, he didn't want to be remembered as the guy that created a submarine. So he started going by Dr. Bush. And he lived out his days in happiness, I guess. I mean, his reclusive lifestyle must have worked, because there is little to nothing about Robert Bushnell once we end the war. Maybe some cliff notes about him being in the Fraternal Society of Cincinnati. The last thing you hear about the man is that he died in 1794, when actually he lived until 1826. So go figure. Now, the turtle. Yes, the history of the turtle, though, will endure. You see, the turtle was the first successful combat sub in history. Though it never sunk a ship, the novelty of underwater warfare was now a reality. So we are now shifting to, Alexander the Great saying, imagine we could sink enemy ships by going underneath them and, you know, poking holes or, you know, making them, you know, or splitting them in half from underneath. You now have a submersible vessel that can deliver an explosive charge that can destroy an enemy ship. And though it would be almost 90 years before a sub was again put into combat, this time it would be the first successful torpedoing in naval history. And it was done in America. Unfortunately, it wasn't done by the American Navy. It was done by the Confederate Navy. The CSS Hunley would be the first ship in the history of the world to successfully torpedo a American warship. So, by point of fact, the Americans were the first people to build a sub, use a sub to sink a ship, and have their ship sunk by a sub. It's a weird paradox, but hey, that's the way warfare goes at times. Though the sub was not successful, the Continental Army tried their hands to try a new tactic in blocking the British Navy, and they were going to try what has been described by at least some historians as fake reefs. They thought that if you could create something similar to a shoal or a reef, that would stop the British Navy. But we're going to get into that more next week. It's an old technology that the Continentals are going to reform and try and make use of in the river fortifications. So we're through two of the five major defense plans that the Americans will put into use to protect not only the Hudson. I've kind of expanded this a little bit more to other. We're going to see as we start talking about things that different plans are going to be laid out for different rivers. And some of the stuff that we're going to test out on the Hudson is going to work great in other rivers and not so great on the Hudson. And some things we put on the Hudson are going to work fantastic that are not going to work anywhere else. But, yep, that's where we're going to leave off to this week. I apologize for what sounds like poor audio quality. It's the last week of school, and unfortunately, I have little time to sit down and actually record an episode with everything that must go on with the end of the year rush. And so I'm doing this very early in the morning without trying not to wake the wife to be, who was sleeping in the other room still. So I apologize if the audio quality is not as great as it usually is. I also apologize that I am not my perky self. It is about 6 a.m. on the East Coast, which is where I'm recording right now. So you gotta, just give me that much. I'll have this posted in a few hours, but that's going to do it for this week. I really am still so thankful to everyone who is posting positive notes on the podcast website, or the iTunes website, I should say. I'm really excited that I'm still getting five-star reviews, please send more. My plan is to do a bonus episode after this before we go into the next campaign. So if you want that bonus episode, I just need a couple more 5-star reviews. Hint, hint, wink, wink. Yes, I am trying to bribe you guys to give me more 5-star reviews. We are gaining a lot of ground on the other American Revolution podcast. It's not a competition, but at the same time, it's a competition. I don't want to be... I want both of our podcasts to succeed. And yes, I do want to compete with him a little bit. And yes, part of me does want to get more popularity than him. But that's just my vague sensibility. In reality, the man who was doing the other American Revolution podcast is a historian like me. His episodes are a little bit longer. I have heard that his episodes are very detailed, whereas mine, though I keep them pretty detailed, I keep them shorter. And my topics are very concise and to the point, whereas his are a little more thematical and, you know, broad overview. Both podcasts, I think, are good, and I hope he's listening so that, you know, he can... you know, hear that I'm actually giving him a positive review. So please, both of us just want the same thing. We want people to listen. My podcast works for my audience. His podcast works for his audience. Both of us want to get more audience listeners. So to get those people out there who haven't heard of American Revolution podcast being in circulation, please go to iTunes, give me a 5-star review. This way, when people look up history, my podcast is right there, right at the top. So that's all I'm looking for. I thank everyone for all the support. Remember, the Facebook is always there if you have questions. I'm pretty good with checking it every day or so, or every 2 days or so. So if a question pops up, I will be looking to see if anyone has if anyone has any questions about anything that we have talked about. That will do it for this week. We will have an episode next week. The week after is a bit shaky. I'm going to fight the Battle of Monmouth, so I hopefully will have an episode to put out, but though I will be in Northern Jersey that weekend, I'm not sure. I do have to fight the Redcoats at Monmouth, and yes, that is a very important thing to do this time of year because it is campaign season. If you live in the New Jersey area... you live close to Monmouth, I believe it is the weekend of the 16th and the 17th, they're having a battle reenactment at Monmouth. I'm hoping it's going to be a big show. I know several groups that I work with will be up there. So we'll see what happens. Everyone, have a great week, and as always, keep the powder dry.